You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Susan Giddings. Woo, a lot's happened. You know, yes. It's the feast or famine, but a lot's happened. And I know what you think. You think we're going to talk about Josh Smith leaving the Bureau? We're not. There's a lot of other things to talk about than the deputy director's departure. We may get to that at another time, but probably it's best to let some time pass anyway to see some other things that avail themselves with that.
Right.
But in the meantime, there have been some changes, and Susan has done some diligence and talked, communicated with decision makers in D.C. Take it away.
So, you know, what got Bruce and I started talking about this was there was a post on the Facebook group, and Bruce and I are really good about kind of hunting down rumors, dispelling false myths, and things like that. Bruce can talk about it, but, you know, throughout our time working in the prison system, I can't tell you how many times rumors would come up. If I heard it once, I don't even know how many times I heard it about paroles coming back. You know, Bruce and I were young puppies when the Sentence Reform Act was passed and the parole went away. And we heard all the time, oh, there was a bill introduced. They're ending parole. Well, there was a congressman out of Hawaii who has now since passed away, who every single year introduced a bill to bring back parole.
Right.
And we are 50 years-ish close to that since parole ended, and parole has not come back. So we really work hard to dispel myths and rumors. So there was a post that made reference to a couple of circuit court cases that came out in April, which one of them we actually discussed specifically on the show. As you guys know, listen to us. We do periodically talk about court cases and things that have come out and new stuff, right? We do that. The other case we did not talk about, because the other case was more, the other circuit case was, and I'll just jump into that first. So there were two cases that were referenced. One was out of the Fourth Circuit back in April 22nd of this year. And that was Benson v. Warden FCI Edgefield. And while there's a lot of interesting comment in it, the circuit court kicked it back, vacated the district court's order and kicked it back, and essentially wanted it reviewed under the Supreme Court Loper case as opposed to Chevron. So what does that mean? For those of you who follow Supreme Court cases, Chevron was a longstanding case that essentially said, allow the courts to give deference to the agency in the implementation of statutes. Agency are subject matter experts. We need to consider their professional expertise, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So with the Loper case that happened, I don't remember the date right now, late in 2025, early 26, I don't remember. It's not important. Chevron was overturned. And the Supreme Court now gave new guidance on where did the deference to the agency end. It wasn't a blank check to agencies. And kind of interesting when you actually read the backstories of the cases, it was actually two of them that made it up to the Supreme Court and they were combined. Those agencies really did some egregious things in interpreting statute, and it came back to bite him in the butt. And the Supreme Court, instead of just kind of throwing out these cases, going back and kind of slapping the hand of these two agencies, they took a broader picture and said, what is how, you know, what is the role? What is the deference courts should give or not give to an agency when interpreting statute? So that's what the Loeb case was. So in regard to the Benson case, we did not discuss it because essentially the court sent it back to the district court to say, hey, you need to consider this in the context of Loper, not Chevron. Now, were there issues related to FSA and when time credits can start and when they can't and things like that? Yes, but that's not what the court looked at. They made some comments about it. They had their opinion, but they did send it back to the court and wanted it reviewed in the context of Loper. Now, the other case reference was one we went over, and it was the Miles v. Bauer case out of the First Circuit. This was decided January 27th of this year. And I'm not going to go over that in like tons of detail, but this was an individual who took some time to get to an institution and was out in a county jail taking programming. And the Bureau came and said, no, like, hey, you don't get, you hadn't gotten to our institution. You haven't been through the risk and need assessment. You haven't done this. You haven't done this. You haven't done this. And both the magistrate and the district court concurred with the Bureau. And the district court, or the circuit court, I should say, the district court and the magistrate court agreed with the Bureau and dismissed the individual's case. So the circuit court comes up and says, you know, we don't agree with you. I will tell you, this is out of the First Circuit. This was up there out of Massachusetts. So put your political hat on in terms of how the decision was weighed. It does make a decision. If you have or haven't not read yet our Unlocking Federal Time Credits book, we talk about the challenges with the FSA when it comes to judicial review and what courts and what district courts, what circuit courts are reviewing and which ones aren't and the different decisions. And the circuit court in that case came back with a whole bunch of things. We don't like the bureaus. Well, I'll share with you because they came back with a whole bunch of things. They basically hated everything the Bureau was doing. So they came back and said the regulation was invalid with regard to providing that a sentence does not commence until the prisoner arrives at the designated facility is invalid, which is actually not what the regulation says, but we'll set that aside. Risk and need assessment is not a prerequisite for entitlement to FSA time credits. FSA time credits are not an entitlement. And as Bruce and I talk about, a risk need assessment does need to be accomplished, primarily because time credits, how much time credits a person has, is in fact dictates how much, you know, if they're a medium or high risk, their time credits are different than someone with minimum and low risk. There's differences, right? Prisoner may earn FSA credit for successful completion of pre-assessment programming, even when housed outside of a federal facility. Would disagree with that. The law actually talks about the EBBR and productive activities and that process. And the Bureau has no way to regulate what is going on in a non-Bureau facility. And they also said that he was eligible for FSA credit based on his work as an orderly during his 15-month tenure at a specific county jail. And they wrapped up their order with saying, we leave it to the district court on remand to determine the appropriate next steps to ensure that Miles is given due consideration for his FSA time credits. We vacate and remand for further proceedings. Okay, so they didn't actually order the Bureau to give this individual time credits. That's important to understand. They sent it back to the district court and said, hey, we need you to give due consideration. And when you go through the 30-some page filing from the court felt that the district court was just kind of dismissive and threw, you know, and didn't give it due consideration. And there was a whole bunch, they kind of lambasted the district court. But the reality is the individual, Miles in this case, wasn't in BOP custody. His programming was his job as an orderly. Even in the Bureau, being in a job detail of any kind is not a cert classified EBBR,
productive activity. Is it a productive activity, though?
No, it is considered a non-FSA activity. Okay. It's part of, you know, if you look at programming, and we actually talk about it in the book. We have a whole chapter on explaining programming, and we talk about this. So, you know, there's FSA programming and non-FSA programming. And FSA programming is divided into two categories: evidence-based recidivism-reducing programming, and what is called productive activities. Productive activities can be a variety of things, but they are standardized across the agency. So, for example, let's pick on, I'm trying to think of one right off the top of my head, Money Smart. Money Smart used to be, was initially rolled out. It was an EBBR. It's been reclassified. In fact, several years ago, it was reclassified as a productive activity. Well, why is it a productive activity instead of an EBBR? An EBBR, as we said, is an evidence-based recidivism-reducing program. So in order for a program to be validated as an EBBR, there actually has to be research that connects offenders participating in this program and then going out, releasing into the community, and not coming back. So one of the major EBBRs that everybody seems to know about is the RDAP program, Residential Drug Abuse Program. 9-month program includes 4 months of, used to be called TDAT, now it's called Community Treatment Services. They changed the name. But 4 months of, minimum of 4 months of community-based programming. And if you're eligible, you can earn your time off, but you're also able to earn time credits, right? It's the one program that has additional completion credit time off if you're eligible. There is gobs of research that says, gobs, that's my technical term, that says individuals who successfully complete the residential drug abuse program and then go out to release, to return to community, are less likely to come back to prison than equally situated individuals, meaning with substance abuse history, who don't. It is evidence-based, strictly tied to recidivism reduction. Now, we'll pick on Money Smart. Money Smart is actually an outstanding financial literacy program put together by the FDIC. It is actually available to anybody. They actually have a couple of programs. They have Money Smart. They have Money Smart for older adults. They have some school-based academic K-12, start teaching children financial literacy. Really, really solid, good programming. Except it's not programming that has been specifically tested against an offender population, and is there any correlation to reducing recidivism? So it can be an outstanding program, structured, outstanding program, but because it doesn't have specific evidence, research, validation, right. Research evidence related to an offender population and recidivism. So it can't just be an offender population, and are they more financially literate before or after the program? That's just financial literacy. Is it also reducing the risk of recidivism? And if it's not, it can be a productive activity. It's just not an EBBR. Now, if you go through the program catalog, you look through, and it is readily available online. It is updated regularly. Whether programs are added or changed or there's updates made, it's done regularly. I encourage everyone to periodically recheck the Bureau's website and look for, and look for that information, see what changes happen. But those programs are Bureau-specific programs. One, they are standardized. They are taught the same way across all 120 institutions. They are the same. They are administered by the same type of staff, whether it's administered by a psychologist or a treatment specialist or a social worker. the catalog, if you look through it, it not only talks about how many hours the program is, what needs it addresses, it talks about the kind of staff who deliver the program. It's all standardized. Why is this important? In order for any validation work to be done, whether that is expanding programs applicable under pattern or looking at a program and saying, you know what? We think it does have relevance for an offender population. It's a productive activity right now, but we do think it has some strong, and we want to track this. In order for that research to be effective, they have to have a standardized delivered program. And if you take a look at the list of programs, nowhere on there are general work details. Those are non-FSA activities. Does the Bureau expect you to expect individuals to have a job? Yep. Do you get in trouble if you refuse to do a job? Yep. It's part of the expectation of being in prison. Does that make it an FSA program? No. It is not. So from a lot of different perspectives, this First Circuit Court is just like so far off base. We have gone over other court decisions, and so we're going to like set that aside. We know those cases within the context. Obviously, the First Circuit just didn't like anything about the way the Bureau was implementing, but there were fundamental flaws in it. So the other part of the post that was on the Facebook group is that the Bureau is releasing new rules through the Federal Registry, new rules, and they're going to be recalculating people's sentences, and they've thrown this out, and everybody's going to get credit going back to the date their sentence is commencing. Date of sentence commences is if you were remanded to custody, it's your date of sentencing. If you were allowed to voluntarily surrender, it's when you voluntarily surrender. That's when your sentence commences. Okay. Somehow thinks this person posted that these rules were also throwing out that you don't have to have a risk and need assessment done. None of that matters, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Effective today.
Effective today.
Came. Well, it's not effective. It was published today. It is effective like September 30th. Here's what the Bureau changed. Got to get to the page. They struck the previous language that referenced arriving at your designated facility. They just struck it. They did nothing. So now the rule reads, when an eligible inmate begins earning FTCs, an eligible inmate begins earning FSA time credits after the inmate's term of imprisonment commences. Okay. That's all they changed. They dropped that the part of the sentence that explained about the arriving at your designated facility. Now, the reason for that is very simple. The law also, while it says an individual can't earn before they were sentenced and can't earn credits before the law was actually enacted, the law also says an individual has to have a risk and need assessment. It also has to, because the risk assessment dictates the risk level, which determines how much credit a person can earn when they go from 10 days to when and if they go to 10 to 15 days, right? Whether or not time credits are not just earned, but also applied. Because remember, the First Step Act created this really convoluted language that created two different criteria, one for earning and one for applying or using, right? So we know we have cases, individual is medium risk level, has a whole bunch of credits earned, and is not getting to use any of them unless they can get an exception from the warden. And so one of the things we do is we review those, we review their FSA risk assessments. We review where they are and can they organically move down to low risk, or is it really not feasible? And if that's the case, and they're going to have to rely on the warden's discretion to grant them an exception, then we turn around and we make some recommendations. We look at what programming they've done. If there's some areas that we think would be better to get their situation in a better place, so that when they make that request to the warden, it's a solid request. We've had individuals talk to us that haven't even had a year clear conduct, and they're wanting the warden to make an exception to allow them to earn time credits. That's not going to happen, right? Okay, so we see this all the time. The law, and if you read our Unlocking Federal Time Credits, we go through a lot of the issues with the law. But the law specifically ties the risk assessment to the amount of credit a person can earn, as well as whether the individual can apply credit without an exception. The law also very clearly ties earning FSA with program participation, and program participation is based on a needs assessment that identifies what criminogenic needs an individual has, and therefore what programming they need to involve themselves in. Because remember, the whole point is to incentivize program participation. Now, the Bureau has made some exceptions in terms of you don't have to be actively in participating in credit in a class in order to earn time credits. The Bureau understands we got a lot of folks doing a lot of programming. There's a lot of wait lists, right? You can just go no further than a recent OIG report that talked about two shows ago, how long people are waiting on wait lists. We know the Bureau knows that's a problem. They're looking at ways to get more programming out to more people. The tablet initiatives is a great opportunity to get additional programming to individuals faster. If you're out here in the world, like we know, you can go to college in person. You can go online. You can have some hybrid. You can earn asynchronously. And kind of work independently, or you can do it virtually, but synchronously, right? So there's all these different opportunities out there that are recognized in the real world. And now the Bureau, with the new tablet initiative, is going to be able to deliver programming in some of these more contemporary ways, getting more programming to people faster. That's awesome. We can talk about more about that another day. But these things have to happen. The idea that the First Circuit thought that an individual being an orderly sweeping the floors in a jail was reason for him to get time credits. We also know in several cases, and we've talked about a number of them here, the courts, because the Bureau came back, and this is something, you know, the Bureau was not explaining their work, and this is the best way to explain it. They were saying, hey, they've got to be at an institution, their designated institution, to earn time credits. Well, why? Well, very simply, risk and need assessments are actually part of the initial classification process. When does the initial classification process start? Within 28 days of you getting to your institution. Initial classifications don't happen in holdover facilities. They don't happen in county jails. They don't happen in detention centers. They happen when you get to a designated facility. That's what has been done in the Bureau for at least 50 years. Unit management's been around since, what, the late 70s? You do initial classification. You case manager reviews the PSR. Oh, you don't have a high school diploma. You need to go down to education and work on your GED. Oh, you have a substance abuse history. You need to go over to psychology and get involved in the drug education program. Oh, you got little kids. You need to go down to education and talk about parenting. And oh, while you're at it, you've never had a legal job. Let's get you looking at some vocational training too. Right? That's what a needs assessment is. Prior to FSA, that's what we did. FSA added some structure to it. That's what I was doing in 1991 and 1992 as a rookie case manager. looked at the PSI, sent the made program recommendations based on what I read in the pre-sentence investigation report. FSA added some structure to that. You know, we now have the Spark 13, which covers 13 different need areas that are both criminogenic needs and responsivity issues that look more holistically. So yeah, I can look at someone's PSR and obviously I can hit, you know, I don't have to be a psychologist to go, oh, you've got a history of some prior substance use. I don't have to be a psychologist to look at a pre-sentence investigation report and say, man, you got some issues. You've had some hospitalizations in the past. You've been on, you know, phases where you've been on psychotropic medication. I think you need to be talking to psychology. Yeah, I could do that as a case manager. I got a college education. I can read a PSR and go, oh, you need more help. What they're doing now is they're using a more structured approach and using other tools the Bureau has, like the mental health care level system, like the medical care level system, other things like the ACEs program to assess trauma, right? The ACEs assessment to assess trauma. Those are all things that make what I did 30 years ago more structured, more formalized, more objective. It wasn't just me looking at a PSR. We've actually got a list of tools we're looking at. And using those tools, we're making assessments. That is not happening in a county jail anywhere. Not for the Bureau. Right. It's not like they're sending case managers. Oh, well, we got a BOP facility that's near this county jail. Let's send them over to do that. The other kind of hysterical thing I thought hysterical was in the Miles decision, the judge seemed to think that the Bureau had some kind of control over when the U.S. Marshals move an individual from a county jail to a Bureau facility. Because, hey, guess what? You're actually not a Bureau inmate until you hit your designated facility, right?
Right.
And the Bureau has also looked at, okay, well, we do have detention centers, right? We got guys, they're in there in pretrial. They go through sentencing, they get sentenced. They're not designated.
They're holdovers.
So then the courts are saying, well, but they're in a Bureau facility.
Oh, their status was still holding.
Their status is still with the U.S. Marshals. Now,
right.
In a perfect world, in an imaginary world in the future, could the Bureau say, okay, they are in a Bureau facility. Could we look at the programming that they might take while they're in holdover status? Potentially.
Yeah.
But I will argue, and I had when I was working, that if you're in a detention center and you're running a non-res, well, this was one of my arguments. If you're sitting in a detention center and you have a non-res program and you have 30 chairs, if you have at least 30 designated inmates who are assigned to the work cadre that are designated at that institution, if you have at least 30 inmates that need substance abuse treatment,
they go first.
They should go first. Now, if you had 100% open seats, that wasn't always happening. I can tell you that. That's why this issue has come up. But that's another issue. But if someone were in a Bureau facility, could somehow we look at that? Maybe. Not we. I'm not a we anymore. Could they look at that? Maybe. But you still have to have your risk and need assessment finished. And in order to do a risk and need assessment differently, because remember, when do you get your risk and need your risk and need assessments completed? During your initial classification. The initial classification is actually dictated in federal rules language. It is very specific. If you go to those federal regulations, which we reference in the book, go to those federal regulations, and it specifically says an individual will receive their initial classification within 28 days of their arrival at their designated facility. And there are a couple additional sentences for other categories, right? So what are we going to do? So let's consider, okay, we're going to change the rules because we'd have to change the federal regs, and that can be done. We're going to change the rules to say you get an initial classification at your designated facility, or if you're in a Bureau detention center waiting transport by the U.S. Marshals. So now there are only so many beds in detention centers. And I can promise you, like Miles, who sat in a county jail, there are thousands of individuals sitting out there that are sitting in a county jail somewhere.
Right.
Is that fair to them? Like, let's talk about disparate treatment. Oh, right. You got to go to a detention center because maybe your proximity, you know, your case was close to one of the detention centers, so they put you there. But my case wasn't. I was in the middle of wherever, and so I got stuck in a county jail. How, you know, the Bureau has to use, because I'm promising you, the Bureau gets accused of disparate treatment all the time. So when you're looking at a clean way to say, what is the timeline? When are we going to do these initial risk and need assessments? The logical answer was initial classification, of course. Why not? Now, there are some other ideas if you're going to let that go. And I won't even get into those because they're kind of, some of them are kind of wild and out there. But there's still an issue. So for those of you who saw that Facebook post, I was like, oh yeah, Miles, and he threw it. Okay, let's put Miles aside. Miles was a pretty hokey decision. So the two things the Bureau did with the new rules language, and you can go to the Federal Register. If you just go to the Federal Register website, put in the search First Step Act, it's like the third one down, it's dated today. I will give you, it is, where's the number? Volume 91, number 167. So that's there. And it's, like I said, but you can also just search FSA and you'll see it's like the third entry. Okay, so that's all they did. They dropped down the explaining about the designated facility. They changed nothing about when the risk and need assessment is going to be done. Zero. So anybody sitting out there to say, oh gosh, golly, and Miles, and I can get credit because I was sitting in, no. Not
until.
Because here's something else that's been happening is the Bureau, because there were several sort court decisions that essentially said, Bureau, you can't just say they didn't arrive. You need to show their work. So attorneys all over the Bureau know when they submit their declarations to the courts are saying, this is when this person was in custody. Here's their record. If they were in a Bureau facility, they're attaching those records. No programming. You don't just get to earn time credits because you're incarcerated. And yes, the Bureau is allowing individuals to earn time credits while on the wait list. That does not translate to everybody gets to earn time credits as long as they're sitting in a prison somewhere. That's not how it works. So for everyone getting excited, and to the person that posted on the Facebook page, that's what happened. They made absolutely no changes relevant to that. The only other change that they made, so that was the first change, they struck language. So now when people file habeases and the Bureau responds, they won't be talking about the date they arrived as a reason for not getting time credits. They will be looking at where were they? What did they do? Did they have an assessment? When was the assessment completed? When was the risk and the need? What programs were recommended? Because remember, it says staff will assign programming. So if you haven't had a risk assessment, if you haven't had your needs assessment,
right?
So no decision has been made about, say, a trauma history, and you decide to sign up for the trauma workshop, which is open to everybody, because maybe you feel like it would be good for you, but it hasn't been identified. Does that mean you're going to get credit? Now, maybe down the road, the Bureau comes back and says, well, you know, we were thinking about it and we see some merit if you came back with a need in this area and if you had taken a class at a Bureau facility during your holdover period. Maybe they think about that. Maybe. But going back to the example of the Resolve workshop, if you don't come back as having a trauma need, once you do the assessment, nothing, because the programming isn't just, oh, I programmed. It's programming right. relevant to the needs.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's a linkage there that we got to be paying attention to, right?
That's right.
So mm-hmm. yeah, this really doesn't change anything. Understand that. Congress, in their infinite wisdom, when they wrote the policy, when they wrote the statute, again, Bruce and I are no strangers to discussing how bad we feel the statutory language is they were not clear, because you've got to read it. And yes, it doesn't take much if you're approaching the statute logically to go, the amount of time credit earned is based on the risk assessment. Well, I've got to have a risk assessment in order to know what time credits I might earn. Okay. I can't earn time credits unless I'm programming, but my programming needs to be based on my needs assessment. So if I haven't had a needs assessment, it's not just about any programming. So there's a logic that sometimes evades the courts, depending on
all the time,
the lens politics and the lens that they look through. Okay. So moving on, the other issue that they addressed, which is kind of funny because the Bureau has actually been doing this for some time. Back when I was still the union management section chief, this was actually a conversation, is do individuals who are treaty transfer cases back into the U.S. So you committed a crime overseas somewhere, you got in trouble, and you filled out your treaty transfer paperwork, and you've now been brought back to the United States. Their process is very different, right? They don't have a U.S. code for an offense code. So they don't have an 841 or an 846, right? They have whatever foreign charge it was, right? And they come back in and they get a post-sentence report. Their sentence is actually calculated by the parole commission. So it looks really, really different. And when we initially looked at who is eligible, right, based on the statute talks about U.S. code. Well, someone who is prosecuted in a foreign court and is a treaty transfer case back in is not prosecuted under U.S. code. So not long before I retired, so I left in early 2024, in the spring of 2024, this actually came up as a, hey, what do we do about these? We had a case and it was like, well, they're not U.S. code, but they're kind of U.S. code because we treat them like U.S. code. Well, what are we going to do with them? The decision was made, like I said, 2.5 years ago, more than that, almost 3 years ago, probably. We're going to treat them like U.S. code. There's nothing that prohibits it. You know, when they come back in, even though it's a foreign court and the commissions, the parole commission's involved, like an old law case, we know they're not old law. The commission just helps us with identifying what their sentence is going to be. They get foreign jail credit, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so back to the new regs. This paragraph, and the paragraph talks about U.S. code inmates being able to earn the FSA. This paragraph will not bar the application of FSA time credits for inmates serving a term of imprisonment imposed in a foreign country and for which the U.S. Parole Commission has determined an equivalent U.S. code sentence under 18 U.S.C. 4106A. So all that rule did was codify what we're already doing and what the Bureau's been doing, I should say, not me. I always forget. I'm not a we anymore. You'd think I'd get that 2.5 years later. All it did was codify, for lack of a better word, put it in the rules language of what we're already doing and what the Bureau has been doing for more than 3 years. So those were the two changes. So contrary to the post that was on the Facebook group, the changes were not that monumental. The courts will, you know, when lawsuits are filed, the Bureau basically took that definition, which is, they've taken it off the table as an argument. Okay, you're right. You can earn time credits from the commencement of your sentence, but you haven't had a risk assessment. You haven't had a need assessment. You haven't had any you haven't been assigned to any programs relevant to the needs that haven't been identified. That hasn't changed. Does the Bureau make a change in the future? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe they look at some strategies to kind of take the wind out of the sails of some of these more liberal courts that seem to think that FSA credit is about serving time. It's not. It's not good conduct time. It's completely different. It is earned credit. You actually have to do something for it. So those were the two. That was big. And the fact that it was fortuitous, I guess, that it was published today. So we get to talk about it today on the podcast. It came out this morning officially. But yeah, it's not as big.
Are you going to make a post on the Facebook group?
Yeah, I will.
Kind of a summary. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll throw a link in there to the actual language, but it's just not a big deal. I guess that's my main point. People should not get excited. Family members should not be running, you know, to loved ones. Oh, get your case managers. Tell your case manager. This is, blah, blah. It's one, it's not effective until the end of the month. But it's also not as impactful as people think it's going to be. Literally nothing has changed.
And herein is another service for perhaps unscrupulous consultants to say, hey, I can help you, da 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 da. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
People will capitalize on family members' hopes or whatever because
Absolutely.
Of these changes. And I can see that lining up. Some of these other ex-convicts have used AI to have their flyer
nice, pretty flyers
on the wall. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And, yeah. Nice and pretty. And, in fact, we had two back-to-back calls today that both conversations were, that's not right. What do you mean?
Man,
I was told I could be hired and I could get more home confinement. No, yeah, you can't
get you only got to be in prison for a couple of days with a year and a day.
Yeah, year and a day sentence. You're going to get there and they're going to immediately release you to halfway house. And then apparently someone else told them, no, you don't even have to go to halfway house. You're just going to check in. I mean, you don't even have to go. You're literally going to check in and they're going to send you to a halfway house. No, that's not going to happen. It's unfortunate. There are, there are some pretty unscrupulous individuals out there. There are also individuals who just don't know, that are not as knowledgeable as they think they are, or are looking at it through the glasses that they want to. That's something you and I have been pretty straightforward about. I mean, we talk about, you know, what does the law say? And a lot of people are wanting to read more into it, but the connections between the risk and need assessment and programming and time credits is pretty clear. That's why I find the First Circuit this First Circuit case so ludicrous. I mean, it might as well be like sci-fi fantasy. But that's Massachusetts, bless their hearts. That's New England. So,
yeah.
So, you know, but it is a good tale and of caution in terms of what the rumors are, getting excited about things until you've actually investigated it. And really then use good sources. Had another conversation with an individual talking to a consultant that has been out of active duty for close to two decades, maybe. I'd have to like do the math, but a long time. And there have been a lot of changes that have happened. And again, you can be knowledgeable. You can have a bureau background and be able to read policy. But all of this FSA stuff, there's a lot there. And folks just need to be really careful. I'm not saying hire us. I mean, Bruce would say hire us. We're good. I'm not necessarily saying hire us. I'm saying do your due diligence. If someone is telling you something that sounds too good to be true, It probably is. Like, oh, you don't have to go to prison at all. You can just go to a halfway house. It doesn't matter that you got a 12-month and a day sentence.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter that the Second Chance Act restricts home confinement to 10% or 180 days, whichever is less. And on a 12-month and one-day sentence, that's 37 days of home confinement. That's math. That's not Bruce and Susan interpreting stuff. That's what the law says. So just always be real careful. Bruce, you were going to say something.
No, we've got about 4 minutes left.
Oh, we are at the end, aren't we?
And so a lot of our work also is just trying to fix what, for whatever reason, the Bureau isn't giving the inmate what they have coming. So we have, this morning, we have guys struggling out there here in Texas that, you know, we got, okay, we'll get with them again today and see what the holdup is on, you know, some of
and sometimes the answer is not as simple. The person, and so I'm going to give a little kind of for Bureau peeps inside. Sometimes the case manager can't fix it. Case manager is the front person. Sometimes that person at the reentry office that's trying isn't the person to actually fix it. It may involve central office. It may involve DC. It may involve central office correctional programs. It may involve central office residential reentry. It could involve a lot of people. And so that person that you're dealing with may or may not be the person. They're the person. They're the only person you got to talk to, but they may not be in a position to fix it. We also hear a lot of case from folks. I talked to my case manager and my case manager said, I don't know. That's what the computer said. Depending on the experience level of a case manager, they may not understand how those calculations happen. Mm-hmm. We explain of that in our books. And I am going to take like this one last couple minutes to really talk about those books. In both conversations that we had with people right before the show and the hour before the show, both people were getting bad information from other people. And I had to be the bearer of bad news. And that's okay. I will always say, I'm not selling sunshine and roses, right? You're going to get facts. But in both cases, we also recommended the First Step Act book, Unlocking Federal Time Credits, second edition. And then if you're on Amazon and you see that one, if you scroll down to the page and it says, hey, people that bought this book also bought, and it's the red book. It's a pretty crimson kind of colonial red, not fire truck red book. And it's called Unlocking Federal Halfway House and Home Confinement Under the Second Chance Act. Those books are companion books. We talk about FSA. We go through all of the components. In the Second Chance Act book, we go through all of the aspects of the Second Chance Act. Yeah, we talk about the history and we give you some context because both of us are also educators. We like to provide that history and context so you kind of know where something happened. And then we talk about the Second Chance Act. We talk about how the Second Chance Act stacks with the First Step Act. We have a whole chapter on stacking, but we also talk about really important things like your correctional timeline. When you're going into prison, understanding what is a typical timeline and what's an atypical timeline for getting your paperwork done and getting home as quickly as possible. So we go through all of those kind of things. We also talk about the five-factor review, what those are. We talk about things that you as an individual should be thinking about when you're thinking about your reentry needs. Is housing important? 100%. Is a job important? 100%. But there are other things. Are you entitled to Social Security benefits? Are you entitled to veterans benefits? Are there other resources? Do you have substance abuse? Do you have minor children? What else is going on in your world that's going to impact your reentry? So that is my soapbox.
All right, folks, Bruce, come by our Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison, First Step Act, our YouTube channel, First Step Act. Reach out to us, ask questions, join the group. Look at the podcast here on LA Talk Radio, also on Apple Podcasts. So please reach out to us. We enjoy talking to everybody and getting you the best information we can. So everybody have a safe week and check your rumors out or call us. If you heard a rumor, call us and let us at least give you the information correctly. So
absolutely.
We are a good resource. All right, everybody. Well, have a blessed week. We'll see you here next time on Around the Block on LA Talk Radio. Take care, everybody. See you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.